This is CRI, China Radio International.
Welcome to CRI News and Reports in this edition. The United States continues phone diplomacy to rally support for a war on Iraq, while China reiterates its opposition to a new UN resolution on Iraq. On the other front, Washington resumes spy flights near North Korea, and China says it's not proper for the UN Security Council to intervene in the Korean nuclear issue at this time. Here in China, the country's top advisory body has a new chairman. We'll update you with more news and reports about as the two political sessions continue. Those stories are more just ahead in this edition of CRI News and Reports.
Hello, I'm Wen Jie in Beijing. U.S. President George W. Bush has continued to work the phones to rally international support for a possible war with Iraq in what his aides called the end stages of diplomacy. In a third day of busy telephone diplomacy, Bush called United Arab Emirates President Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, Philippine President Gloria Arroyo, Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Britain has proposed a six-step test to measure Iraq's compliance with its obligations to disarm, hoping to break a deadlock at the United Nations by persuading the countries on the UN Security Council to back a resolution that will justify the possible use of force. France has rejected the new proposal, saying it doesn't address the issue of seeking a peaceful solution to the crisis, and more time should be given for Iraq to disarm effectively. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has opened a debate on the Iraqi issue. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says an attack against Iraq without UN approval would be illegal and not win international support. European Commissioner for External Relations Chris Patten says the European Union will not provide financial assistance to post-war construction in Iraq if the United States launches the war without the approval of the United Nations.
Here in China, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Kong Qiuan has reiterated that China opposes the adoption of a new resolution on Iraq. At a press briefing, Kong Qiuan says Resolution 1441, which was approved by 50 members of the UN Security Council, is still being implemented. In addition, the UN weapons inspections in Iraq have made progress and been effective, which shows the inspections are necessary. The inspections should continue, even though there are difficulties and problems in the inspections. Kong Qiuan stresses that the urgent task is to implement Resolution 1441 well and strengthen the inspection based on the results achieved. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Kong Qiuan says it is not proper for the UN Security Council to intervene in the North Korean nuclear issue at this time. As a member of the panel on the North Korean issue, Kong Qiuan says China thinks that dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea is the key to solving the problem, and China hopes the two sides will make efforts in this regard. Meanwhile, the United States is resuming spy flights in areas near North Korea, despite the alleged interception of a U.S. spy plane by the latter's fighter jets earlier this month. The U.S. officials said the U.S. military has plans to send RC-135 spy planes back to their spy missions in international airspace off North Korea. You're listening to China Radio International. We'll bring you the latest news and in-depth reports about the two political sessions currently underway in Beijing right after this.
People with mental retardation are also capable of becoming athletes. Special Olympics, created for the mentally challenged community, has been introduced to more than 160 countries. This week's Voices from Motherlands features Special Olympics official George Smith. He will talk to us about such issues as what events are prepared, who can take part in them, and how the movement is progressing in China.
It really is a misconception that people with mental retardation cannot do sports, cannot play side by side. Quite the contrary. You know, our athletes, if they receive good training by good coaches, can really perform at a very, very high level in sports.
For more on Special Olympics, tune in to CRI's Voices from Motherlands, broadcast every Thursday.
Welcome back. Now we go to Guan Juanjuan for the latest news and in-depth reports about the two political sessions in Beijing.
China's top advisory body, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, elects a new chairman. 63-year-old Jia Qingling, former mayor and party secretary of Beijing, becomes the chairman of the 10th National Committee of the CPPCC. Turning from politics to culture, should China adopt a film rating system? If so, what kind of rating system should it establish? We'll talk to a professor from Beijing Foreign Studies University who's an expert in the field. But first, the news. Former Beijing Mayor Jia Qingling has been elected chairman of the 10th National Committee of the CPPCC, China's top advisory body, at its fourth plenary meeting. A CPPCC member speaks highly of the new chairman.
Well, we have a lot of to expect from him. We hope that under his leadership, the CPPCC will play a more active and more positive constructive role in Chinese political life.
A total of 24 vice CPPCC chairpersons were also elected at the meeting. Meanwhile, the draft list of candidates for senior Chinese leadership posts has been endorsed by the presidium of the ongoing legislative session and will be distributed for discussion by all National People's Congress deputies. The list includes candidates for the positions of chairman of the NPC Standing Committee, Chinese president and vice president, and chairman of the Central Military Commission. It also includes President of the Supreme People's Court and Procurator General of the Supreme People's Procuratorate, as well as Chairman, Vice Chairman, and members of the Special Committees of the NPC Standing Committee. Now, CI's Li Peichun will bring you a profile of the newly elected Chairman of the CPPCC National Committee.
63-year-old Jia Qingling was born in North China's Hebei Province. After graduating from the Hebei Engineering Institute in 1962, he worked in the machinery industry for over two decades. In 1985, he became a Fujian Provincial Standing Committee member of the Communist Party. He was later promoted to the post of the party chief, and then the governor of the province till 1996, when he was transferred to Beijing to become deputy secretary of the Beijing Municipal Party Committee. Between 1996 and 2002, Jia Qingling was acting mayor, mayor of Beijing, and secretary of the Beijing Municipal Party Committee. In November 2002, at the 16th National Party Congress, Jia Qingling was elected standing committee member of the Political Bureau of the Communist Party. During his term as mayor, Jia Qingling imposed progressively stricter standards for air quality. The measures he took included the banning of the use of poor quality coal. He kick-started infrastructure projects in the city, including an extension of the subway system, transportation of natural gas into Beijing via pipelines from China's northwest, and the expansion of the city's airport. He also drew up plans to develop between 10 and 15 high-tech industry groups in fields such as electronic information, biotechnology and new medicines in the capital city. Jia Qingling recruited corporate executives to help improve the city's international image in a bid to attract more investors. Beijing residents may find comfort in his pledge to introduce a comprehensive social safety net for the city. And his success in placing laid-off state workers has also earned praises from the people in the capital. Before being elected chairman of the CPPCC, he told its members at a panel discussion about what he thought the top advisory body's work should be.
First, all the political parties, especially the Communist Party, should treat each other equally with respect and let everyone fully enjoy their political rights guaranteed by the Constitution. Secondly, we should promote democracy and fully play the role of consultant and advisor to the government. Thirdly, we should unite and cooperate with each other, always seeking common ground while tolerating each other's differences. In one word, we must stick to the principle of long-term coexistence, mutual supervision, sincere treatment of each other, and a strive for democracy and solidarity.
Thank you, Li Peichun. The chairman of the National Committee of the CPPCC presides over the work of the National Committee. Candidacy of the chairman and other members to the National Committee is proposed by political parties, non-government organizations, and people representing various walks of life in the CPPCC and elected by the plenary session of the National Committee. The chairman serves for a term of 5 years. The CPPCC is an organization with wide representation. It's an important organ of multi-party cooperation and political consultation under the leadership of the Communist Party of China. The major function of the CPPCC is to conduct political consultation and exercise democratic supervision, organize its members to take part in the discussion and management of state affairs.
To build a well-off society, we should focus on the countryside.
Some of my proposals have been put into action, and as for those not adopted, I was given satisfactory answers.
My proposal is a law on brain death. This could reduce the waste of medical resources and promote organ transplants.
Welcome back to CI's special coverage of the NPC and the CPPCC sessions. Wang Xingdong is a screenwriter based in Beijing. As a CPPCC member, he proposed, with the increasing prosperity of the film industry, the time has come for China to introduce a film rating system.
2 years ago, when Wang Xingdong put forward the same proposal, he received a lukewarm response. This year, he decided to submit the proposal again, after a recent experience of seeing a film full of scenes depicting homosexuality and incest shown in the primary school. Moreover, he believes that, as China a member of the WTO, the time is right to put forward such a proposal.
With China's entry into WTO, the domestic film market has been connected to the international one. As it is an international practice to establishing a film rating system, it will be necessary for us to do it if we're going to have cultural exchanges and film imports and exports. This is a demand of the international market.
Wang Xingdong adds that, as China's film market is now being driven by a market economy, the introduction of a rating system will also help divide the market according to the different tastes and needs of different audiences.
It is beneficial for screenwriters, film directors and audiences, because both the targets of artistic creation and the film market will become clearer and more specific.
Unlike 2 years ago, this time round, the proposal received support from many film industry insiders, such as renowned film directors Zhang Yimou and Feng Xiaoning. Mainland film star Gong Li also voiced her support.
I think this is very good. Actually, we often talk about this, and I think if it is implemented, it will be easier for filmmakers to create their works and pass through censorship.
But that is not to say that the film rating system is something that is agreed on by all. Huang Hong, a comedian who has just stepped into the film industry, expressed his own opinion.
I think presently the most important thing is to develop a film culture in China, because the domestic film market cannot be said to be thriving by any means. Without winning back film goers, it is not the right moment for us to create a rating system.
Huang Hong fully agrees with the idea of setting up a film rating system in China. The problem is when and how. Whether the time is right or not, one thing is for sure. China's film industry is becoming more and more mature as it integrates with the international market. Shen Ting, CRI News.
Thank you, Shen Ting. Most Chinese people are familiar with the idea of a film rating system from the movies they have seen from America. So how does this system work in the United States? I put the question to Professor Peng Jimeng from Beijing Foreign Studies University.
There are actually several rating systems. First one is the general audience, which is supposed to be all ages admitted. The second is the PG system, the so-called parental guidance suggested, which means that some material may not be suitable for children, and that's why you need guidance see by the parents. The third one is the PG-13. That means parents are strongly cautioned that because some material may be inappropriate for children under 13. And the next one is the R rating, and this R stands for restricted, which means that those under 17 would require accompanying parent or adult guardian in viewing these movies. The last, I think but not least, is NG-17, which means that no one under 17 or under 18 may be admitted into a movie theater.
Professor Chen, based on what you have just said, let's assume if China adopts a film rating system, do you think that we should copy the film's rating system directly from the United States?
I don't think so, because I think we have to take into consideration the specific situation here in China. For example, China doesn't have a kind of well-developed, mature film industry market. And since this market is not mature, we still have a long way actually to improve and to make it mature. And that is why I think we have to consider several of the elements in setting a film rating system. For example, we don't have a movie market for the children or for people like in between 17 and 35 or above. So I don't think that we can have that many specifically rating systems in China.
So which suggestion you would put forward?
Well, generally speaking, I would say that the old system, the so-called children not admitted or material not suitable for children, have been quite outdated. That seems to be the only rating here existing in China. What I suggest is that China should adopt a system that suits its own national characteristic or national situation. I think that there must be a more specific criteria instead of one general thing guiding the whole industry. I think that there at least should be a general audience, meaning all age admitted rating. Also, plus this PG rating. PG is almost worldwide in Britain, in Canada, in Hong Kong, in countries and regions around the world. It's quite prevailing. So I would suggest that at least we should have two rating systems right now. See, the general one and also the PG rating.
I've been talking to Professor Teng Jimeng from the Beijing Foreign Studies University. Professor Teng, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Due to the numerous construction projects, some cultural relic sites have been damaged.
Only through increasing farmers' incomes can the government really expand the effective domestic demand.
Agricultural products should get easier access to markets, and farmers should have better access to modern technologies.
Welcome back. The two sessions have been underway for almost 2 weeks. How should the Chinese media cover the political event that has the biggest effect on Chinese people's lives? Should they just follow and report on the big names at NPC and CPPCC sessions? CRI's Chen Xuefei looks at the role the media plays at the ongoing two sessions.
Before and after the meetings, thousands of journalists have interviewed NPC deputies and CPPCC members. Yet an article published in the People's Daily quotes renowned TV anchor Jing Yidan as warning the media not to be hooked on interviewing big names only, but also to adopt a broader approach. The anchorwoman thinks some media try to attract as large an audience as possible by covering celebrity participants, but forget the responsibility of giving their audience objective and complete coverage of the events. On newly emerging social issues, a senior advisor from the CPPCC says China is a country rich in culture, but contemporary society has seen a growing momentum of culture vulgarization, such as an increasing number of pornographic messages through popular mobile phone SMS services. The Guangdong-based Yangcheng Evening News covered group discussions on urban management by representatives from South China's Guangdong province. Many of them argue that urban management strategies should be set in a comprehensive way as it relates closely to development of the surrounding underdeveloped zones. And international media also follow events in China closely. The Associated Press has a report on the unemployment issue raised at the current NPC session. The article says China's economic reforms launched in 1979 have let millions of Chinese lift themselves out of poverty, noting the progress China has made with an experimental system of basic living allowances for the poor. A report in the Singapore-based Lianhe Zaobao hails the discussion on improving the life of Chinese farmers. It gives an example of a popular TV series, Liu Lao Ge, broadcast recently on China Central Television, Channel 1. The author says the program portrays the contemporary life of farmers and shows the Chinese government's increasing attention to raising the standard of living in rural areas.
Thank you, Chen Xuefei. With that report, we come to the end of today's special coverage of the NPC and CPPCC sessions. Tomorrow, Friday, China's top advisory body, the CPPCC, will conclude its annual session, where the newly elected CPPCC chairman will deliver his closing remark. CI will broadcast the event live at 9 a.m. Beijing time. As for China's top legislature, the National People's Congress, deputies will be deliberating over the candidates for the country's top posts, such as the president, vice president, the NPC chairman, and the chairman of the State Central Military Commission. That's all we have for today's special coverage of the two sessions. CI's News and Reports continues with more news from China and the rest of the world. Now back to you, Wenjie.
Thank you, Guan Jianjuan. Coming up as CRI News and Reports continues. U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney is to visit China next month. China expresses deep sympathy over the death of Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Dindic. Iran and Russia reject U.S. accusations that Iran is seeking to develop weapons of mass destruction. We'll also bring you the latest on the Asian stock market. Stay tuned.
In this week's Life in China, we'll talk about the country's efforts to fight poverty and improve living standards. We will invite members of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference to talk about the poverty issue. Also learn how farmers' lives have improved by tapping local resources. That's all on Friday's Life in China on China Radio International.
Welcome back to CRI News and Reports. I'm Wenjie in Beijing. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Kong Chuan announced Thursday that U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney will visit China in April. Speaking at the regular press briefing, Kong Chuan says Cheney's advance team recently paid a visit to Beijing and held talks with China's Foreign Ministry about his upcoming visit to China. Kong Chuan says mutual visits of senior officials from the Chinese and U.S. governments and exchanges of opinions on international issues have promoted trust and understanding between the two countries and led to better bilateral relations. Speaking about the assassination of Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Dindic on Wednesday, Kong Chuan says the Chinese government has expressed deep sympathy over Dindic's death and sent condolences to his family. Kong Chuan says the Chinese government appreciates the efforts Dindic had made for the friendship and cooperation between China and Serbia. He stresses that China has always condemned and opposed terrorism of all forms. China hopes and believes that Serbia and Herzegovina can maintain stability and development. China says it supports the International Atomic Energy Agency's contribution to the efforts against potential nuclear terrorism and attaches great importance to the security of radioactive sources. Speaking at an international conference on security of radioactive sources, Vice Chairman of China's Atomic Energy Authority, Xu Yuming, says China fights all kinds of terrorism, including nuclear terrorism, and believes that every government has the duty to fight nuclear terrorism. Iran and Russia have rejected U.S. accusations that Iran is seeking to develop weapons of mass destruction. Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Karazi and his Russian counterpart Igor Ivanov have signed a joint statement in Tehran, vowing to strengthen their nuclear energy cooperation. The two sides reaffirmed that they would continue to do so in the framework of the International Atomic Energy Agency. NATO Secretary General George Robertson has urged former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and former Bosnian Serb Army commander Ratko Mladic to surrender to the Hague-based UN War Crimes Tribunal. In a statement issued in the Bosnian capital of Sarajevo, Robertson says the wanted war crime suspects should present themselves, as no hiding place is safe forever. It notes that surrender is the only face-saving way, given that all governments in the former Yugoslav region have passed laws to cooperate with the UN tribunal. UN Chief Kofi Annan has requested that the Liberian government severely punish the people who killed three UN humanitarian aid workers in the country. Anand demanded that the Liberian government investigate the incident and called on various parties involved in the country's internal conflict to pay attention to the security of civilians and humanitarian aid personnel. Liberia has expressed its condolences for the deaths of the three UN aid workers. A Chinese health ministry official says China is to invest $150 million on its vaccine system this year. He explains that vaccine is the most economical, efficient, and safest way to guard against diseases. Last year, China spent $100 million on vaccines. Contagious diseases threaten the lives of people at all age levels. Nearly 6 million people in the world are saved by vaccines every year. And now let's take a look at Asian stock market. Stocks on the Chinese mainland closed lower Thursday after two sessions of modest rebounds. In Shanghai, the composite index fell 10 points to 1,465. In Shenzhen, the component index tumbled 18 points to 2,978. In Hong Kong, the Hang Seng index closed down 88 points at 8,787. Tokyo stock slipped Thursday. The benchmark Nikkei stock average dropped 74 points to close at 7,868. And that's market information. Now recapping this hour's top stories. The United States continues phone diplomacy to rally support for a war on Iraq, while China has reiterated its opposition to a new resolution on Iraq. Washington is resuming spy flights near North Korea. And here in China, the country's top advisory body has elected Jia Qinglin as its new chairman. That concludes this edition of CRI News and Reports. For program producer Na Lan and the rest of our news team, I'm Wen Jie saying thanks for joining us.
Hello.
皆さんこんにちは。
サルタン。
여러분안녕하십니까?
Guten Tag.
ごめんでした。
CRI brings you voices from other lands.
Hello and welcome to this week's Voices from Other Lands. I'm your host, Lee Pei Chuan.Most people are aware that Beijing is preparing to host the 2008 Olympic Games. But you may not know that the city of Shanghai will play host a year earlier to another international sporting gala, Special Olympics. Special Olympics is not the same as Paralympics designed for the handicapped, but was created for people with mental retardation, including those who are autistic or who have Down syndrome.Unlike the traditional Olympic Games, Special Olympics is held all year round and at different levels, from international down to community level. But what events are being prepared for these athletes? How many such athletes are there worldwide? And how's the program doing in China? With us today is George Smith, Vice President of Special Olympics East Asia, based in Beijing. Hi, George. When was Special Olympics initiated?
Well, Special Olympics was started in 1968 when we held our first World Games or International Games. It was created by Eunice Kennedy Shriver, and it started very small and with an event in Chicago at Soldier Field. And there were only athletes from the United States, Canada, and a few from France.
Ms. Shriver, is she related to President Kennedy?
Right. She was the sister of President John F. Kennedy.
Does she have a child or relative with mental retardation, which prompted her to do something for people with similar conditions?
Well, yes, she had a sister, or has a sister, Rosemary, who has mental retardation. And I think that was one of the things that prompted Mrs. Shriver to pursue activities like Special Olympics. However, she's very, very socially minded and had done a lot of research on all the activities for that were happening and the services that were being provided for people with mental retardation for her brother John Kennedy when he was the president.
Special Olympics is still unknown to most people around us. Is it a sports program?
Well, the core mission of Special Olympics is a sports program. Its mission is to provide sports training and athletic competition in a variety of Olympic-type sports for people with mental retardation. So primarily it's a sports program, but it really is much, much more. You know, as we've seen how people with mental retardation can really succeed in sports, we've added a lot of other programs that are built around the program. We do a lot in terms of involving families. We do an awful lot of having our athletes, once they've competed in sports, assume leadership roles, becoming public speakers, becoming volunteers in our program. So while sports is the core mission, there's much more attached to it.
How often are the International Sports Olympics held?
Our World Games are conducted similarly to what the traditional Olympics are. We hold our games every 2 years, alternating between a Winter Games and a Summer Games, occur the year before the traditional Olympics. So our next world event are our Summer Games in 2003 in Dublin.
This summer.
They'll be in Dublin, Ireland. And then the 2005 Winter Games will be in Nagano in Japan. And then the 2007 Games have just recently been awarded to China and the city of Shanghai.
How many athletes do we have around the world?
Well, currently we have about 1.2 million athletes participating from approximately 160 countries around the world. So it's very, very big.
What do mentally challenged people have to do before you recognize him or her as an athlete in the Special Olympics?
Okay, well, first of all, Special Olympics is for people with mental retardation. So the people in our program around the world have been diagnosed as having mental retardation. Most of them are receiving services like special education services in school. And in order to participate, they have to be 8 years old. And then they have to do a certain amount of training before they can start their competition. So they would enter maybe in their schools, and their school would take part in Special Olympics, and their coach would train them for a certain period of time, and then they would start taking part in the local activities that occur.
When people ask you about Special Olympics, what do you explain to them most? I mean, what are the biggest misconceptions about Special Olympics?
Well, I think the biggest misconception is that people with mental retardation can't really succeed in sports, and quite the contrary. You know, our athletes, if they receive good training by good coaches, can really perform at a very, very high level in sports. You will see many of the games here in Beijing, and certainly at our World Games, there are athletes that just stun people. That because you're mental retardation doesn't mean you can run. In fact, we have athletes that run the marathon. Because you have mental retardation doesn't mean you can't lift weights, because in fact we have athletes who perform and can lift much heavier weights than certainly I. So it really is a misconception that people with mental retardation cannot do sports, cannot play side by side.
What events then do we have in Special Olympics?
There are actually 26 official sports now that are recognized in Special Olympics. So in the Summer Games, you have a lot of the traditional sports that you'd see in the regular Olympics, the basketball and volleyball and table tennis and sailing and equestrian. We do have some sports that are not in the Olympics, such as we have golf, bocce, bowling.
What is bocce?
Actually, it's a game that's, many countries call it lawn bowling, or it's a game where you throw a ball and try to get it near another ball, and it's something like shuffleboard or lawn bowling. It's a fun game.
When it comes to the traditional events like basketball, volleyball, are they played the same way as is done by mentally abled people?
Yeah. And I think that's the other big difference in Special Olympics, is that we are not just for the elite athletes. Our programs and our competitions are designed very specifically to engage people of all ability levels. I'll give you two examples. In basketball, there are a variety of events that athletes can take part in, from 5-on-5 basketball, just like you would see in the Olympics or just like you'd see in the NBA, played by the same rule for those athletes that can do that. We also have a half-court game where they play 3-against-3 and just play at one basket. And then for those who aren't even ready to play the modified game, we have what we call skills competitions. So they could compete in competitions where how fast you can dribble, how good you can pass, how good you can shoot. So there's a lot of degrees of the events that would engage people. In individual sports, for example, like track and field, we have everything from the marathon to a 10-meter walk. We have everything from the shot put to a tennis ball throw. So again, the events are set up so that no matter what ability level, there's something that you can compete in.
And also the athletes are divided into groups according to their age, their...
and their ability. It's a process we call divisioning. And again, it's meant to give everyone a reasonable chance to succeed so that at any event, for example, in the 100-meter event that you would see being run, there might be 10 different divisions of the 100-meter. Every participant will get an award. Really is a way to value the athletes, no matter if they're the best or if they're just learning.
The severity of mental retardation varies from individuals to individuals. From the pictures before me, athletes with light conditions can compete quite the regular way. But what about athletes with the most serious conditions? Do they include people with severe Down syndrome, and what events are prepared for them?
There's so many causes of mental retardation, and Down syndrome is just one condition that has accompanying mental retardation. But you will see some individuals who are very severely and profoundly mentally retarded who also have accompanying physical handicaps. So people who have very low intelligence quotients, very low IQs, but and also have some physical disabilities, they're the ones that are the very hardest. And we have a program now called Motor Activities Training Program, MATP, which is really very much like a physical therapy program where people are trained at the very simplest things to grasp an object and then release it. And in that program, it's designed to do very basic kind of physical therapy. The competitions are held where they're not competing against other people, but they compete against their own personal bests, so that no matter what they do, even if it's to be able to pick up a block and move the block 1 centimeter, it's a program where we try to promote activities for everybody, even at the very profound and severe level.
You're listening to China Radio International. This is our Thursday feature, Voices from Other Lands. I'm Li Peichun, and with us today is George Smith, Vice President of Special Olympics East Asia. George has outlined a general picture of the sporting program for people with mental retardation. In the second part of our show, we'll focus on Special Olympics in China.
Wherever you're from, New York or New Delhi, London or Lagos, whatever your field of expertise, be it an actor, doctor, scientist or novelist, we welcome you to share your experience and interest in China here on Voices from Other Lands. Contact us by email at voices@cri.com.cn or give us a ring at Beijing 6889-1603. Again, that's 6889-1603. Make your voice heard on Voices from Other Lands.
2001, the Special Olympics Board of Directors decided that China and East Asia were of critical importance to its future. They voted to create a new East Asia region to support the work in China and in East Asia. And that was when you came to China, right?
That's correct. Our board of directors decided to create the East Asia office because of the incredible work Special Olympics China was doing. Special Olympics China has embarked on the largest campaign for growth in the history of Special Olympics. They have grown from 25,000 to now well over 100,000 athletes, and we have a goal of by 2005 to have 500,000 athletes participating in Special Olympics in China.
So that's 500,000, about a quarter of the world total.
World total by 2005 is expected to be around 2 million. So yes, China would represent a quarter of the number of athletes in the program.
When was Special Olympics first introduced to China? Before it was, had the country launched any similar programs for its mentally retarded people?
Actually, it was introduced back here in about 1985 when Eunice Kennedy Shriver's husband, Sergeant Shriver, came over here and met with some officials in education and in the Ministry of Civil Affairs. There weren't sports programs at that point or any other similar program. There were certainly special education schools where athletes were receiving some training in sports, but really nothing that to this magnitude.
Last September, Special Olympics China hosted the third National Summer Games in Xi'an. You and your colleagues were there. Tell us how it went.
Well, I can still remember it like it was yesterday. It was probably the most impressive games that I've ever gone to, and I've been working as a professional for Special Olympics since 1981. And so I've been to a lot of games, and this was clearly one of the best run games. Just to give you an example, opening ceremonies were as good as anything you'd see on TV in the regular Olympics. They had wonderful entertainment. Many government leaders came there. They were shown live on the provincial television. They were rebroadcast on CCTV. It was just wonderful. And the sport venues were absolutely world-class. You walked into the table tennis venue or the track venue, and you would think you were at the regular Olympics. There were athletes from every province throughout China, and the competition was fierce, and it was just wonderful. You know, those games also had many, many firsts involved in it. For example, not only were the athletic competitions world-class, but they held the first-ever family summit, where families from around China came to meet and talk about issues that they're having in terms of having a child with a disability and what they could do as families to support more the future of their children. We had the first ever youth summit here in China, where athletes in our program came with their peers from regular education schools to talk about what it's like to be a person with mental retardation, what it's like to not have a lot of friends who aren't mentally retarded. And the students, the regular education students, talked in very specific terms about how they could become better friends, become better neighbors, and to encourage more inclusive activities between the special education schools and the regular education schools.
Have Chinese athletes taken part in any of the previous international Special Olympic Games?
Yes, they've been participating in the quadrennial games since 1985. They will have a delegation coming to 2003 in Dublin of about 100 athletes, and they will be participating in, I think, 10 sports. So they've done very well at World Games. They also come to Winter Games, as you might expect. Some wonderful speed skaters from Harbin in our last Winter Games were just fantastic.
Which part of China is seeing the best Special Olympics movement?
Our five-year plan for development certainly is looking at going at about 40 focus provinces and cities, and we started with the major cities, so Beijing and Shanghai and Qingdao, Wuhan, Shenzhen were our first targets, and those are the ones that are really thriving now. But as we do more training and as Special Olympics China is building capacity to go out and provide guidance and support and assistance, you know, the smaller provinces are starting to also grow.
Let's talk a bit about things in Beijing. How many training schools are there here in Beijing?
Right now there are 19 special education schools that are involved in Special Olympics, and two or three times a week the athletes are training in their schools. They may be competing against other schools every once in a while, and you know, on a fairly regular basis we may have some citywide competitions for them to compete in.
The schools are operated by the Chinese educational authorities,
but
how are you involved in their programs?
We basically are involved in their programs as kind of an extracurricular activity that, you know, we work with the teachers in the schools to provide them training and provide them materials like our coaching guides, rule books, and they take that on just like an extra sports programs.
Okay, some of our listeners may have a family member or friend who is mentally challenged. Where do they go so that the individuals can be an athlete?
I think there's a couple different ways. Certainly they could contact our office directly or the China Disabled Persons Federation that's headed up by Mr. Deng Pufang. Our Special Olympics China organization is kind of part of that organization, so they could contact Special Olympics China through the China Disabled Persons Federation, and then they would link them up with one of our local training programs at the school or in the community-based programming.
In China, what are the difficulties in launching programs for the mentally retarded people?
You know, first of all, again, it's just trying to mobilize enough volunteers and create enough awareness, you know, and dispelling some of the myths that sport is not only good for people with mental retardation, but it should be an essential part of their lives. The second issue is certainly the facilities. You know, many of the special education schools don't have big gymnasiums. Many of the special schools don't have tracks. And most of them don't have any facilities indoors. They may just have a yard. So it's trying to find ways that we can use city facilities or use universities or use regular education schools. So trying to find the facilities. And I think the third is certainly relates to some of the funding. You know, to run world-class sporting events, you need equipment, you need uniforms, you need transportation to the competitions. And so, you know, we're working very hard to try to find local support for Special Olympics and for these programs.
Special Olympics is a non-profit organization which depends on corporate or individual sponsorships. I've learned that your office in central Beijing was donated. And now I'll give you a chance to say a few words to people who have rendered help to Special Olympics in China, as well as those who are willing to help.
Yeah, we have just had terrific support from the community here. And I think that, you know, first of all, our offices are donated by News Corporation. And so we have just a lovely spot in Oriental Plaza that is just free of charge. And I think that, you know, we have had incredible support from all of the business community. And I hate to start mentioning names. I think, you know, it's been interesting too, because, you know, a lot of the corporations are doing it because they think it's the wise thing for a corporation to invest in our program. And not only is it nice because they give their money, but they want to also give their time. And many of our corporations, their employees come and volunteer. Their employees come out to support our events. And so it's been a great opportunity for corporations not only to donate money, but to really get their employees actively engaged with our athletes. And, you know, once they meet a Special Olympics athlete, it's probably our best form of maintaining relationships with corporations, because they become friends and they really do see firsthand in a very personal way how their money and their time, their support can help.
As you mentioned earlier, Shanghai will be hosting the 2007 Special Olympics World Summer Games. How was it selected?
Special Olympics runs their World Games bidding very similar to the International Olympic Committee, where we would encourage bids from cities from our seven regions within Special Olympics. So we are just extremely delighted that the 2007 Games will be in Shanghai. It gives us the opportunity to lead up to those 2007 Games and build awareness and build programs. We're anticipating that there will be about 7,000 athletes from 160 countries. We would anticipate in excess of 30 to 50,000 family members and friends of those Special Olympics athletes to come to Shanghai to witness those games. We certainly are hoping that we would have live broadcast of opening ceremonies that would be fed globally. It's just going to be a fantastic event.
Finally, George, you've been working with Special Olympics for more than 20 years. How important do you think it is to people with mental retardation besides giving them chances of having fun?
Well, I think it's extremely, extremely valuable. Competitions that we hold are held in very, very public places. It's a chance for us to get people with mental retardation out into the public's eye. And then when young people see them or the general public sees, they say, wow, you know, they can really compete in sports. If they can compete in sports, you know, they could probably be good employees. They could probably be good neighbors, and they certainly could be good friends.
That's about all the time we have for this week's Voices from Other Lands. We've been talking with George Smith, Vice President of Special Olympics East Asia. Before we end our show, I'd like to quote the father of a mentally challenged U.S. boy, who says, "People always ask me what it's like to have a special child in our family. I used to try to explain, but now I don't. I just say, I'm flattered. Flattered that God judged me worthy enough to raise a human being as wonderful as my son." Well, that may explain why George believes it is inspiring to see so many happy families at the Special Olympics Games. This program has been produced by my colleague Li Gang, and I'm Li Peichun. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next Thursday with more Voices from Other Lands.
Learn Chinese now.
朋友们，你们好，欢迎收听现在学汉语，我是曼丽。
我是 Stuart.
Well, we've learned to ask someone your age or younger their age. Now we'll learn how to ask someone who's definitely older than you.
We'll get a bit more formal and use 您, the polite form of 你. Listen, 听, and repeat, 重复, and try to guess what 年纪 means. 年纪.
白先生, 您多大年纪了? 白先生, 您多大年纪了?
我六十七岁。
Mrs. 马。马女士，您多大年纪了？马女士，您多大年纪了？
我五十九岁。我五十九岁。
Everybody now ask Mr. Lee, who is older than you, his age.
很好。李先生，您多大年纪了？
And answer...I'm 84.
没错，我八十四岁，八十四岁。So, did you guess what 年纪 means? Yes, 年纪 means age, the age of a person, not the age in information age or something like that. So, 您多大年纪了?
It is like...你多大了? Which we learned in the previous lesson. We just add 年纪, N-I-A-N, J-I, 年纪.
Now, everybody ask me how old I am. Pretend I'm older than you.
很好, 白先生, 您多大年纪了?
100, 100岁, 100岁. Not really, of course. Now ask old Mrs. Zhao, that's Manly, how old she is.
没错,赵女士,您多大年纪了?99,我99岁。
Now guess the meaning of this. 99岁,
他已经很老了。对,我年纪很大,我已经很老了。我年纪很大,我已经很老了。很老,很老,
very old. 她已经很老了, she's already very old. 她已经很老了。对,我年纪很大,我已经很老了。What
is 年纪大? 对了,age big, meaning of course old, like 老.
But what about asking the age of kids under 10 or so? It's easy, listen.
你几岁了?你几岁了?我八岁。我八岁。你几岁了? Remember, the 几 in what's the time now? 现在几点了?现在几点了? Where the 几 means how many? Well, it means a similar thing here. 你几岁了? You how many years? How old are you?
And remember, 你几岁 is for people under 10 or so.
So, Stuart, 你几岁了?
Manly, 你今年几岁了?
I think it's time to 下课, 再见!
再见!
You've been listening to the English Service of China Radio International. We've now reached the end of this one-hour program, and we hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or suggestions, you'd like a program schedule, or if you'd like to know the frequency for your area, write to us at the English Service, China Radio International, Beijing, China. The postal code is 100040. Or you can reach us by email at crieng@cri.com.cn. You can also visit our website at english.cri.com.cn for more news and other information about China and the rest of the world. On behalf of the CRI team here in Beijing, this is Wang Lu saying goodbye and thanks for joining us.